We are talking with Randall Carlson about the cosmic origins of the Holy Grail catastrophe and recovering the lost signs of the antiquity, pretty much. So I wanted to ask you before we kind of proceed and obviously talk more about all these things, the connected items around, you know, the Holy Grail and the ages of catastrophe that we kind of went through. I wanted to know a little bit more about Ganung Padang in Indonesia. There's some very interesting work being done there right now. I think that you guys posted something on it as well. We had a development story a couple of days ago, actually. What do you know about this site? It's a very strange megalithic site. Tell us more about it.
Well, I only know the little bit that I've learned from Graham Hancock, and he really is the best source of information on that now because he's explored that site. I'm only just now learning about it, so I don't know that much about it. I know Cameron, after we met with Graham a few weeks ago, I know that Cameron posted some of that information online. And then again, it seems to be, you know, amongst this collection of things that's emerging from the distant past, that certainly suggests that there was, like for with Göbekli Tepe, which is in Turkey, which I know a little bit more about, but there seems to be, at least Graham has now identified what appears to be about four or five megalithic sites that are, you know, as much as 10 or 12,000 years old. And Ganung Padang, you know, certainly seems to fall in that category of ancient site. But again, I don't know that much about it yet.
Definitely, there's more work to do there than I know. Exactly. I saw a post as well that that Graham did. I think he'd been down visiting the site pretty much and walked around
in Indonesia, in West Java, Indonesia. And yeah, he was just visiting that just very recently. And so, you know, he's got pretty much the cutting edge information on that. And all I know is about it is the little bits and pieces that I've gotten from him. And it's going to be featured in his sequel to Fingerprints of the Gods that he's writing, which I believe is going to be called, what is it? Magicians of the Gods. Yeah, Magicians of the
That's
Gods.
That's right, yeah.
And so I'm sure that he'll have a lot of information about that in there and Göbekli Tepe as well, and a couple of these other sites that he's been investigating that appear to be much older than, you know, than conventional history. So I'm looking forward to learning about that.
Exactly. Yes. Same here. Much more to learn on that note. Now, I wanted to go back a little bit then, if we go back to kind of the great story a little bit and ask you a little bit more about the Red Rain. I can't recall exactly what some of the conclusions were that you know, science that came out of it. But the fact is that if we look at things like even the, what's it called, the plagues of Egypt, pretty much the 10 plagues, we have a very kind of, it seems to me anyway, a very similar scenario of how environmental impact is bringing that story about. But the Red Rain here in India, that was like 2001, I believe, that happened, right?
Yes. Yes, there's been a couple of episodes of it within the last 10 or 12 years. And just very bizarre. I mean, and you know, in our earlier discussion, talking about that period, the Arthurian era, there are a number of interesting throwaway remarks in some of the ancient texts. Let's see, the one that I think I've got a number of them quoted in the articles, the series of articles that I've posted. One that's particularly striking to me was by Roger of Wendover. He was writing in the 13th century. And he wrote that in the year of grace, 541, which falls right in the middle of that span of time we're talking about, there appeared a comet in Gaul so vast that the whole sky seemed on fire. In the same year, there dropped real blood from the clouds, and a dreadful mortality ensued. Hmm. So, you know, that's very suggestive. The red blood, which, you know, has been examined, we won't call it actually blood, but its constituents is very much like red blood. You know, that I first encountered this reading in the Journal of Astrobiology, which is one of the science journals that I read regularly, that I find quite interesting because it dovetails with all of this information that we're talking about. But yeah, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, Kerala or Kerala in India.
Yeah.
It was in July of 2001. And what happened was that there was an airburst event on the 25th of July, I believe it was, and it was just hours before the Red Rain first started to fall. And I'll quote here from the International Journal of Astrobiology. This conclusion, the fact that there was this association with an airburst just prior to the fall of the rain, this conclusion raises the possibility that in space, there are objects that contain red blood-like cells. In other words, comets possibly harbor life. Yeah. Such an image of a comet containing a liquid interior teeming with red cells is difficult to imagine and even harder to accept. But then, you know, when you begin to go in back into the literature, you find all of these bizarre tales that would ordinarily be dismissed, you know, as probably being the fanciful ravings of some, you know, pre-scientific illiterate. But now I think we're in a position where we can begin to look at these in a different light. The Celtic traditions are full of stuff like that. The superhero Cuchulainn, who strikes the hills with his rainbow-sized sword and then slays an enormous bull that arrives, as it's described, arriving over the eastern horizon. And then when he's pierced by the sword of Cuchulainn, the bull's blood flows over the landscape. You know, then there's, oh my gosh, there's so many of these accounts that the purpose of my articles is to just document at least some of those.
Yeah. No, it's very, what do you think that, what could produce that? I mean, red, if it's close to red cells, you know, red blood cells, that there's everything is in there, DNA and everything. I mean, it can't be something that's formed out there, right? It has to come from somewhere.
Well, that's the mystery of it. Where, you know, and I think some of the ideas put forward by people like Chandrawick Ramasinghe is that the interior of comets may actually provide a suitable container for the evolution of these primitive life forms. What's the ultimate origin of them? I don't think at this point anybody's willing to stick their neck out and say they know the ultimate origin. You know, did it, you know, there have been many ideas, you know, for example, that, oh, you know, some of the early on, some of the organic material may have been delivered to Earth from Mars when an asteroid struck Mars and knocked material off into space. I don't think anybody necessarily thinks that's the case anymore. But I think what Fred Hoyle and Wick Ramasinghe were getting at was this idea that the comets themselves may harbor this material that's really primordial stuff that goes back to the very origin of the solar system itself, that there may have been an organic component to the raw material out of which the solar system itself formed, and that this material is preserved within the nuclei of comets that are now residing in deep space, and that, in a sense, this material is in a state of deep freeze or hibernation, and when the comets come into the inner solar system and begin to become energized and begin to disintegrate, that this material can then be released. And if it happens to fall onto a planet where the environment is suitable, it can trigger it can catalyze a process that then leads to what, you know, we might characterize as evolution or mutation of species.
Right. So it's not until it comes into our kind of environment that it's, that those building blocks might be able to expanded further, or that's, yes, when like the evolutionary, you know, path can begin, I guess, right?
Yes. Yes. It needs a suitable environmental matrix in which to be introduced. You know, in order to culture the material, it has to be, you know, inserted into a test tube with the proper environment in it, and then it will begin to proliferate, and our planet seems to provide that.
Well, if we have directed panspermia, if that is the case, and if it's even a possibility that then we might have a, you know, directed these extinction events as well, which again of course opens that can of worms. But the fact is that I don't know. It's just if we're on that kind of path of rise and fall by design to a certain degree, and I'm not saying that it's you know, aliens or anything like that, but it could be just a part of the cyclical nature of the cosmos that was for some reason, you know, woven into the plan, I guess, to, you know, give either different life forms, the ability to rise and fall or something like that. I mean, it might be a mechanism of the design. That's what I'm saying, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, what you're getting on, you're broaching into this subject matter that, you know, is, it takes us really some of the deepest epistemological mysteries. You know, what is the source of life? What is the source of, you know, us? Where do, in consciousness? And I think that what seems to be emerging now from the evidence is that very primitive life seems to be very robust and very prevalent, and possibly can survive in quite a variety of extreme environments. In fact, that's why many of these very primitive life forms are referred to as extremophiles, because of the fact that they have this ability to survive, you know, extreme temperatures and an extreme range of temperatures, both towards the hot end and the cold end. And but the thing is it's a vast leap to go from, you know, a primitive unicellular organism to an animal or a human being.
Yeah.
And here I think we're getting into the idea that only in a very narrow range of circumstances is that kind of evolution possible. In one of the articles, in fact, I think it was the one most recent one we posted in this series, one of the things that I get into there is how the unique architecture of the solar system has now been, it's been realized, is exactly suited for the delivery of comets to the inner solar system. There's been this work by, what was his name again? I've forgotten the name of the original authors. Let's see, there was a couple of them. Harold F. Levison, that was his name. He, a number of years ago, they published, their findings were published in Science News. And I'll just quote very briefly from a couple of highlights from that article. A new study reveals that the locations of the four large outer planets play a crucial role in shepherding comets into the inner solar system from a layer beyond the orbit of Pluto. From Neptune to Uranus to Saturn to Jupiter, quote, comets are being handed off from planet to planet, says Harold F. Levison. It is this celestial bucket brigade, he notes, that allows a select group of comets to grace the skies above Earth, flaunting their dusty tails as they deliver key organic compounds into our atmosphere. If this gang of four were spread further apart, comets that rank as frequent flyers to the inner solar system, visiting at least once every 60 years, could never make the journey. If the outer planets were bunched closer together, the orbits of these comets would look radically different. In simplest terms, comets leave the belt because it has, and this is the Kuiper belt, which is the zone of comets outside the orbit of Neptune. The comets leave the belt because it has a slow leak. Once a comet falls into Neptune's gravitational clutches, the large outer planets start to exert their own gravitational influence. In this way, some comets from the Kuiper belt make their way toward the inner solar system, where they come alive in the sun's warmth. Yet the new calculations by Levison and Duncan show that one shouldn't take such a model for granted. It's only because Neptune, Uranus, Saturn, and Jupiter are spaced exactly far enough apart that each has a chance of handing off a comet to the next. Huh. So I think the point of this research is that if we didn't have this, the present architecture of the solar system as it's laid out, there would not be a way of delivering these comets from the outer zones of the solar system into the inner zones, where they could possibly now seed life into the proper planetary environment.
Huh. Interesting. Now, yeah. What does it say anything then about, you know, if we look at the Kuiper belt and what, I mean, how did, I don't know if you believe in the standard, you know, formulation, if you will, of the solar system per se, but are those just remnants of you yes. know, failed planets, and they just those, happen to have components within them or something?
That they are remnants of the primordial material that formed the collapsing nebular cloud. So that as the cloud picks up angular momentum and begins to rotate, some material consolidates into planets. And of course, now I'm referring to the more conventional model. Mm. But I think it makes sense. And then with Jupiter, what happens with Jupiter is that the outer planets tended to essentially fling this material, if you will, to the outer reaches of the solar system, where it's in a sort of a metastable condition. That is, in a situation where it doesn't take much to perturb them from their orbits. And you got to picture that the Kuiper disk is orbiting. It's turning slowly about the sun, just as everything else is. And it's moving in the same direction as the plane of the ecliptic, or as the planets do in the plane of the ecliptic. And so it appears that this is the material that was left over that just didn't consolidate into planets. And once the planets consolidated, particularly the large outer planets, gravitational perturbations of those planets caused this material to eject to the outer reaches of the solar system where it accumulated. And it's estimated that there could be, you know, hundreds of billions of comets in the Kuiper disk, perhaps trillions of comets within the Oort cloud. Now, the Kuiper disk is much closer in. The Oort cloud reaches like from 20,000 to 50,000 astronomical units, which is an extraordinary distance. The Kuiper disk is within that, within the Oort cloud, and it reaches all the way into almost the planetary orbits, such as Neptune. In fact, some speculation is that Pluto may actually be originally have been an object within the Kuiper disk. The larger objects that are being found out there are referred to as Chiron objects.
Chiron objects.
C-H-I-R-O-N. And Chiron was Chiron. He was out of Greek mythology.
The wounded healer, I believe. Wasn't that the one?
Yeah, I believe that's correct. Cameron was inserting something here. What'd you say, Cameron?
Yeah.
Well, I think you're right. He was a centaur, and I believe he was an instructor.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Yeah, the centaur Chiron was known as the wounded healer, having been poised as one of Hercules, poisoned by one of Hercules' arrows. But because he was able to heal himself, he suffered thereafter from an incurable wound. Interesting.
Yeah, okay. I don't know the story of why these particular objects came to be called Chiron objects. I would like to look into that.
That is always interesting, though, isn't it? Because there is, again, if we look at this from an esoteric point of view, and even some of the art that you guys have included in the series, that is highly rich in symbolism, which has a connotation and connection to all these things. You know, the head on the plate kind of thing. You have the John the Baptist imagery, and you have other just alchemical art overall, like Albrecht Dürer, his name, where he, his melancholia and all that. You have recurrent themes of these comets coming into them for some reason. What is the significance on that? Why is that important, do you think, from a more esoteric alchemical point of view, Randall?
Well, getting back to our discussion, I mean, I really think that from alchemy, what we're doing is the idea behind alchemy is that the alchemist is in his laboratory, in his alembicum vitrum, is mimicking the fundamental processes of organic creation. And so I think what we're seeing is that there's an analog, a cosmic analog to that. I mean, when some of the medieval texts refer to the Latin phrase, I've forgotten exactly what it is, but it essentially translates as celestial agriculture. I think we're getting right into this domain that we've been discussing here, this idea that, life is seeded throughout the solar system and that the proper environment has to be prepared in the same way that a farmer would go out and prepare his field before the seed is introduced. The planet had to be prepared. Of course, this is sort of getting into this implication of directed panspermia, but that's the alchemical model, I think, that we're looking at here, is that the idea is that of celestial agriculture is that, this whole thing is in a sense a vineyard. It's and then you look at the metaphors, throughout mythology, and particularly in the New Testament, the metaphor of the farmer and the fields and agriculture is constantly being invoked as a metaphor for these processes. And I think that ultimately what's behind all this possibly is the idea that there is this cosmic science and that remnants of this cosmic science have been preserved through the traditions of alchemy and through the traditions such as the Grail literature. And that it's only once we have our scientific understanding has evolved to the point where we can begin to understand these ideas of, for example, of panspermia, that we can begin to look at this information inherited from these these predecessors of ours in a new light and see that, well, there's a whole lot more to this than anybody had imagined, you know, a generation ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. What about the basic cup idea then, that this is, you know, and again, how you think that this was translated into the Arthurian legend, because it's almost like that kind of took over more than the actual, you know, cup of Jesus that they had at the Last Supper, right? Do you know anything about how that kind of transition happened, how it been so prominent in Britain?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that the idea of the chalice, you know, the cauldron of Braun, was considered to be a cauldron of plenty that preceded Christianity. It was a Celtic tradition. And I think many of the Celtic traditions were grafted into early Christianity. And I think there was a deliberate effort to essentially recast a lot of these more ancient pagan traditions within a cloak of Christianity. And so it became, you know, the chalice that Joseph of Arimathea used to capture the blood dripping from the side of Christ as he was, you know, undergoing the crucifixion on the cross. And of course, there seems to be much more to this, the whole idea of the crucifixion, than, you know, conventional Christianity seems to recognize, in that it seems to hearken back to many of the earlier myths about the sacrifice of a divine king, you know, the slaying of the god or the son of the god, and what that had to, what the implications of that were for, you know, the replenishment of a devastated earth. Have you seen the movie Prometheus?
Oh, yeah. Certainly. Yeah.
You recall the opening of that. You have one of the engineers essentially sacrificing himself. And if you recall, he throws himself into the watery matrix, which represents the at this time the inorganic or abiotic hydrosphere of the planet. And as he throws himself into it, he disintegrates, and his DNA begins to proliferate throughout the hydrosphere and begins undergoing its process of replication. And so, in a sense, you know, I think that all of these you know, sacrifice myths, and even down to you know, Christianity and the crucifixion, harken back to this idea of some sacrifice of some life form that was necessary in order to instigate the processes of terrestrial life.
Right. Yeah, exactly. The DNA begins to reformulate at that point once it's been, you know, dissolved. And of course, that's a very, you know, conscious process, as they show it in Prometheus there. But yeah, it's very interesting. Very interesting how that's kind of come through, and it's been preserved and kept, and the stories are, you know, continuing in that way. It's not, you know, going away in the first place. It seems to take new shape and come out in new forms. But again, it's like the art alone there has been has shown a lot of this as well. Now, how do you interpret the sacrifice bit to this then? Is it meant to be as a story towards all of us individually, that this is how you when you give something, you can get something back kind of thing, or what you put into it is what you're going to get back? Or is it more an altruistic story than that, do you think?
Well, I think it applies both to us individually as individuals and also collectively as the species. I mean, clearly we see the fact that, you know, there's this tradition of, you know, wise of all highly evolved people suffering, you know, persecution, you know, whether it's Giordano Bruno or Hypatia or Jesus or any number of these others who, you know, underwent persecution and sacrifice for the fact that they were trying to uplift and enlighten their fellow man. So I think it certainly applies to the idea of the individual, but I think it also applies to the whole idea of the species, in that, you know, right now, if we look at this planet and we think of the fact that, and we begin to realize how catastrophic the history of Earth has been up to this point, and the repeated disruptions of the biosphere, and the you know, the devastations that have occurred, the mass extinctions, and then the necessity of replenishing the Earth after, in the aftermath of these events. It's my take on this, contrary to what, you know, many of the, you know, the current mode of environmentalists thinking, that humans are a pariah upon the earth.
Yeah.
That really we are going to ultimately be the salvation of the earth, because what modern environmentalism is failing to take into account is their thinking is still rooted in the old uniformitarian models, the old gradualist models, where, you know, all change occurs, and literally it has been described this way in textbooks for, you know, most of the 20th century, that most earth change takes place one grain of sand and one drop of water at a time.
Right.
And we now know that that's so far from the reality of it that there have been these numerous catastrophes and major disruptions within the balance of nature that have in some cases completely reset the ecological clock, set it back, you know, from thousands of years to millions of years. And, you know, that first became apparent by looking at the history of life on this planet. We realized that life was subjected to these nonlinear interruptions of the normal pace of things, and that there were mass extinction events, there were enormous geological and geophysical changes accompanying these events, and then they were followed by a hiatus that was eventually then followed by a rapid speciation event, where there is this sudden, inexplicably rapid proliferation of variety of species. And this seems to have occurred over and over again throughout the history of life on Earth. And now we're beginning to see that that same type of a model applies to the history of civilization, human civilization. And that we're beginning to realize, and this again gets back to Graham Hancock's work, that, you know, civilization on this planet may be much, much deeper than conventional history recognizes. And that when we're looking at, the first records of history, you know, written records from 5,000 to 6,000 years ago, and we're looking at the first appearance of major cities, you know, 8,000, 9,000 years ago, when we're looking at the domestication of animals, you know, 9,000 to 10,000 years ago, when we're looking at the establishment of agriculture 9,000 or 10,000 years ago, when we're looking at the dispersion of languages 9,000 or 10,000 years ago, why all of a sudden, after tens of thousands of years of human presence on Earth, why in those couple of millennium did everything start to happen? And that now we've got to explain why we have such a scant record of what went on for tens of thousands of years prior to, you know, the advent of what we think of as modern history. And I think that the explanation becomes is that we have undergone, our civilization has undergone a parallel process to what is life itself has undergone on this planet. These repeated interruptions with the advent of all these things 9,000, 10,000 years ago is not really the inception of these things, but the rebooting of civilization after this global catastrophe that essentially erased whatever had been here prior. And that this could have happened multiple times, you know, in the span of time that humans have been on this planet, which goes back at least 150 to 200,000 years that modern humans have been inhabitants of planet Earth. You know, we could have done a lot in those times, but again, we have very little record of it, you know, other than cave paintings and so forth. So I guess one of the ideas I'm getting at here is that, you know, the planet has suffered enormous depredations, actually far in excess of anything that we have yet done to it. And I think that the modern environmentalist movement, as I was saying, tends to be, it's thinking, when the modern environmental movement began back in the 1960s and early 70s, the gradualist paradigm was totally dominant in our understanding of Earth history. And within that framework, it's you know, easy to imagine that what we humans were doing to the planet was the most extreme thing that had ever happened, considering that all change preceding this had been, like I said earlier, one grain of sand or one drop of water at a time. But when we realize that even a small bolide striking the Earth releases, you know, thousands of times more energy than our entire nuclear arsenal at the peak of the Cold War detonated all at once, you know, we begin to have to, I think, rethink, you know, just how robust our planet is and how capable it is of recovering after these type of events.
Yeah, yeah.
And this really seems to be the case. I mean, we can look at some of these events that I call them the 100 million megaton events that have happened repeatedly throughout Earth history. You know, at the peak of the Cold War, the arsenals of the superpowers had about 10 to 12,000 megatons. And a megaton is a million tons of TNT. Now, by contrast, the atomic bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were maybe 15 to 20 kilotons. So a 1 megaton bomb would be on the order of 1,000 times more powerful than the bomb that took out Hiroshima. That's a 1 megaton bomb, right?
Yeah, yeah.
In the arsenals, we had roughly 10 to 12,000 megatons. And if we had released all of that in an all-out global thermonuclear war back in the 60s or 70s, it would have created a, even in the absence of radiation, it would have created an environmental catastrophe unprecedented within historical times.
Right.
It would have caused mass mortality. It may have caused extinction of species and lots of environmental disruption. Round numbers, 10,000 megatons. Even a small asteroid striking the Earth would be thousands of times more powerful than that. Thousands of times more powerful than the entire nuclear arsenal of the superpowers being detonated all at once. And this has happened over and over and over again in the history of the Earth. So, you know, when you begin to understand it in that context, you realize, you know what, this planet is a lot more robust than it's being given credit for.
Right, exactly, but yeah.
Within that framework, what actually may be the very vulnerable and fragile entity is human civilization.
Yeah, well, good point. So it speaks a little bit to the idea as well that whatever we do as human beings is, you know, we just spread evil in our path kind of thing. That, what you know, it has really turned on its head in the expectancy that humans now should not leave a single footprint on the Earth, literally. That, you know, as they talk about carbon footprints and everything else, it's literally like you're born onto the planet, but it's like no one should even notice that you were here kind of thing. With our deepest minds and everything like that, it's like compared to even the thickness of the crust of the Earth, like it's very small what we're, the impact that we really are having on the greater, you know, body, right? I mean, I'm not saying that we should, you know, violate everything and burn all those, you know, forests and everything. Of course not. I'm not talking about that either, but I'm just saying the fact is that the forest industry has been replenishing, you know, the woods in the, at least in the areas where they're responsible and everything else. Sometimes it's spun in such a way that it's like we are the cancer and the plague on the Earth kind of thing. And I don't like hearing that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
No, and I think it's totally misguided.
Yeah.
Totally misguided. Yeah. And the folks that are propagating such ideas just haven't really considered or haven't learned or studied about the history of the planet in a geological sense, in a biological sense. Because if they immerse themselves into the emerging studies of catastrophism for a few months, they would have to come away with a different perspective on this thing.
Sure.
You know, and really what we are doing is, I think we are evolving the technologies that can actually prevent those kind of events from happening in the future. Because even a small asteroid, half a mile in diameter, striking the Earth, would create environmental havoc far beyond anything that we have done. It would create, you know, I mean, it could perhaps be enough to put us into another ice age. Now, you know, you think about the onset of the last ice age. You had 6 million square miles of forest reaching from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from northern United States to the Arctic Circle. You had the onset of the Ice Age, and essentially 6 million square miles of forest were obliterated under the ice.
Yeah.
And to imagine now, for us to do such an equivalent thing today, we would have to clear cut every tree from the Atlantic to the Pacific and from the northern United States to the Arctic Circle.
Wow.
And, you know, again, nature did that. We didn't do that. Nature did that. See? And then for the next 10,000 years, no forests grew there until the ice melted. Likewise, as the ice was coming on, sea levels dropped 400 feet. Now, imagine what that did to the shallow marine ecologies. Imagine what that effect would have had on the coral reefs, the fisheries, you know, that basically live on the continental shelves. It would have been enormously disruptive and destructive, far beyond anything that we have. I mean, think about it. Yeah. Drop sea levels 400 feet. What's that going to do to the shallow coastal marine ecologies? Far more devastation than anything we have yet perpetrated. See, and they're failing to take these kinds of things into account. And like you said, it's not to say that, hey, we should have free rein and free license to do whatever we want. No, that's not the idea. But we have to put this thing in a realistic perspective.
Yeah, exactly. Well, again, I brought this up before, but it's to the point where the nature conservatives in that regard, those who want to conserve everything just in the shape that it is, don't take into account that before man were here, these are systems and things that have been operating for millions of years before we showed up on the scene. It's even like, okay, a tree falls over, you know, a creek where you know, salmon goes up, basically, and they go out and build a little ramp so that they can go up there, you know, kind of thing. It's like, it's over the top in to the point of where there is preservation. You see what I mean? It's, and even to the point where we might actually do it a disservice, where those natural challenges that do arise in the environment cause the species to actually, change or maybe even evolve in a certain degree. But it's almost like we're trying to stop that as well now, you know? So it's bizarre.
The question I would ask is, okay, what is your ideal steady state? Where can we go and actually find, okay, here this represents now the pristine steady state balance of nature, and this is what we're going to try to strive to you know, restore to this. But when you actually try to pin it down, it isn't there.
You can't. There is no such thing. It's always in flux, always changing.
It's extremely dynamic.
Yeah.
So yes, I'm basically trying to, you know, advocate for a new environmentalism, which basically takes into account these cosmic forces, and we realize that the planet is extremely dynamic, and that we humans actually are an integral part of the natural order of things.
Well, exactly. Good point. And
if you believe that there is a wisdom within nature, well, then the emergence of humans out of the substrate of terrestrial nature is part of the plan.
Exactly. Well, that's a very good point, a very interesting one. I think, again, if we take the assumption that we come out of the system, then the purpose of, you know, how we're developing and everything has been there. I mean, you can think it's maybe bizarre or weird in that regard, but just think about all the things that we've managed to come across in our own development. It's almost even that the design of the oil itself have been put in place there for a certain time so that we could take an advantage of it for a certain time. And again, I think everything leads to something new, and you evolve, you advance in your technology. But what I'm talking about is that period, those periods of developments that we've gone through, civilization-wise, technology-wise, and everything else, seem to have been working very well together with nature in that regard, right?
That's my feeling, you know. And, you know, to me, the whole discussion is sort of epitomized in the global warming debate that's going on. And in spite of the fact of what's being claimed, that, you know, the debate about climate change has only just begun. And, you know, when we begin to look at the, you know, the idea of the fact that, you know, we're releasing a small amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, you know, we're looking at presumably pre-industrial carbon dioxide concentrations of 280 parts per million. Right.
Right.
And it's assumed that this was steady state for a long time. I think there's a lot of evidence that refutes that idea, because that's based solely and exclusively on entrained air bubbles captured in glacial ice. And there have been a number of challenges to that, suggesting that the concentrations in glacial ice are not necessarily reflective of the average global concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere at the time that snow fell over that particular ice cap. But in any case, 280 parts per million is almost at the threshold where plants can't even grow, because without CO2, plants don't grow. CO2 is the fuel for photosynthesis, right?
Yep.
And why is it, you've got to ask the question, why is it that greenhouses, you know, professional greenhouses that are growing, you know, all kinds of plants, increase the ambient CO2 concentrations three times greater than the current atmospheric, because plants grow better under 1,000 or 1,200 parts per million than they do under 200 or 300 or 400 parts per million.
Right. Yeah.
And there's been enormous amounts of research done over the last 50 years or so, hundreds of experiments looking at the effects of increasing the ambient CO2 concentrations on plant growth. And in virtually all cases, what you see is this tremendous and dramatic proliferation of plant productivity, biological productivity. You also see an increased resistance in these plants to extreme changes within the environment. So in other words, in a CO2-enriched environment, plants are much more able to, for example, withstand drought conditions for a longer period of time than in a CO2-impoverished atmosphere.
Interesting.
And you know, if you look at also projections of the total number of hectares of forests believed to, you know, the projections for around the turn of the century that were being made in the 60s and 70s, and then you look at the actual square miles or square hectares of forest, once we begin to actually do satellite surveys and we're able to accurately count the area of the Earth's surface that was becoming reforested, what we were seeing was that, you know, 20 to 30% more forests than anybody had projected. In other words, the forests are recouping much faster and they're growing in places where in living memory, you know, plants and trees haven't grown before. And, you know, then you've also got along with that the idea of what has been referred to as the missing carbon sink that first got recognized, 20 or 30 years ago, which is that based upon the amount of gigatons of carbon we're putting into the atmosphere through fossil fuel burning, which is about 6 billion tons per annum, only about half of that is actually showing up in the atmosphere. So it raises the question is where is the missing carbon going? Well, it's probably going a number of places. Some of it's going into the ocean, but a large component of it is also going to fuel plant growth. And what is happening, and I think that once we can strip away the propaganda and look at the evidence that is now being well documented from the biosphere, what we see is that this slight enhancement of the CO2 of the atmosphere is triggering a greening of the planet.
Right.
And this, of course, if you say this, if you bring this up, you're accused of being, you're a ringer for the fossil fuel industry.
Sure,
you're obviously on the payroll of the fossil fuel industry. Well, no, I'm not. I don't work for anybody. I peruse the literature. I've read over the last 25 years, I've probably read 2,000 articles on climate change from the quote unquote peer-reviewed literature.
Yeah.
And what I find ironic is that most of the people that are invoking the peer-reviewed literature have never read any of the peer-reviewed literature, so they don't know what's in there.
It's fantastic, isn't it? Yeah. That's in itself is amazing, but I don't know how many times we've talked about this with other guests on the program too, that, well, wait a minute, you know, the studies are there, the data is there, all the science is actually being done right there, but the direction where we're heading is completely opposite to what that data is saying. It's fantastic, you know?
Yeah. And again, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, the point of this, and I'm sure that there's going to be somebody listening who's, you know, and I've been accused of this before, you think it's just okay to just run rampant over the earth and destroy everything. No, that's not the case. What I'm saying, though, is that if we don't have a realistic perspective on this whole question, we're not going to be able to effectively or intelligently respond to it.
Yeah, and, yeah. Well, we have to be responsible, obviously. That's not the point here. We're not asking responsibility to go out the door, but we're asking to put, just as you say, to put all these things into perspective. And again, also at the question of what costs, because it seems to be that there is this, as you said, a carbon madness. And to a certain degree, it almost seems like it's a conspiracy to try to shut down the very functionality of the system as it is. We're going out to like hunt carbon and like take it out of the atmosphere almost. You see what I mean? It's like, yeah. What?
Well, bear in mind, you know, when you CO2, so you've got a carbon atom and two oxygen atoms. Through the process of photosynthesis, one carbon atom and one oxygen atom are taken up by the plant, but it releases an oxygen atom.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's not only fueling greening of the planet, it's putting oxygen back into the atmosphere, which I think is generally considered to be a good thing. You know, we places to breathe pure oxygen because it's invigorating, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So again, I think that, you know, what has happened, though, is the whole question has been hijacked towards a political agenda. And that's too bad because there is a real science of climate change. And of course, you probably have noticed that the terminology has shifted over the last few years from global warming to climate change.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you look in the pro-global warming literature, you constantly see the references, and I read a lot of it because I like to look at all sides of the issue. You constantly see references to, you know, climate change this and climate change deniers without ever really specifying who these climate change deniers are. my challenge would be, please name one, because I don't think you'll find a single climate scientist anywhere on the spectrum of belief that thinks that climate doesn't change.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, give me a break. Climate changes, and that's recognized, I think, by every single climate scientist out there. The question is what is the actual effect of, you know, an 80 part per million enhancement of the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, and what is that contributing to climate change? That becomes the question. And that question, I'm sorry, it has not been resolved yet.
No, exactly. And the focus there again is that we're asking, basically what we're asked to do is to basically shut down all of the the methods of production that we have as a human species, at least in the Western world at this stage. And it's what would the price of that be? We would effectively, with the technology we have right now, we would effectively be going backwards, right?
Oh, we would be going backwards, yes. And the human cost would be incalculable. To me, it's like we've gotten to a point where we're 7 billion people now, and I think I always like to say I think we're like at the halfway point right now, and I look at this more in broad cosmological terms, which is basically that, you know, we come to this idea that life came from outer space, and ultimately life wants to return to outer space. That Earth is essentially a womb, if you will, for the emergence of higher life forms. And I look at human beings and our science and our technology are, you know, as being instrumental in nature's grand design of returning life to the uninhabited cosmos.
Interesting. Yeah.
And, you know, what'll happen is that right now, as we've seen in the history of the biosphere, is that life on the surface of a planet is vulnerable. And, you know, like any business, you know, that wants to survive an economic downturn, you diversify. Well, I think life is trying to diversify, and that ultimate diversification requires or demands that life become cosmic. And human beings, I think, now are the instrument by which life can become cosmic. I think that life wants to proliferate throughout the solar system and ultimately throughout the galaxy. And one of the things I'm getting at in this series of articles that I'm writing, and that we just touched upon, is the unique set of circumstances that would be necessary for the emergence of higher life. And I think when you begin to take into account all of these unique special conditions that are necessary for the emergence of a higher evolved life, I think that the higher you go up the food chain, if you will, the more limited become the environmental contexts in which that can occur. So that when you get up to the level of human beings, the range of environments is extremely narrow. Whereas the very primitive unicellular life forms, like we were talking about earlier, can exist in a broad range of environmental conditions. The more complex the individual, the more complex the species, the narrower the range of environments in which that species can exist.
The more sensitive it is to a certain degree then, yeah?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And so what we've seen is that when we begin to look at the architecture of our own solar system, we didn't even talk about the necessity for the presence of a large satellite and what the role that would play
right
in creating an intertidal zone that would allow, single-cell marine life to actually, or more multi-cell marine-based life to evolve onto a terrestrial life form, because it provides this transitionary zone. Take the moon away and you have no intertidal zone. You've now removed the means by which marine life could become land-based life. Mm. And so we could get into a whole, I think that somebody should, maybe I myself should try this, write a book on these unique set of conditions that are actually would be necessary for the emergence of higher life forms, complex life forms. And to show that within that framework, yes, we may be discovering all kinds of other planetary systems in the galactic neighborhood, but none of them seem to have the right conditions exactly like the ones we've got here. You see, and it seems now that it's the architecture of the entire solar system that has to be in place in this very special way for this whole process to even happen, you see.
Yeah, exactly. It's a nursery for that genetic diversity to arise in all these different species and everything. It's pretty remarkable when you think about it. And again, we've brought this up before, but even the fact that the relationship, as you say, between the moon and the solar eclipse with the size of the moon over this. I mean, it's a machine. Someone has made this, you know, it's designed.
Yeah. And your term nursery, that's a very good one. I'm going to start using that. Cause I'm always fishing for terms that will
please
convey
go ahead.
This idea. Yeah. Exactly. Nursery. Yeah. Yes. That's a good way to put it. So, yeah. So what I guess, you know, the upshot of this is that I think we need to kind of reevaluate, you know, our role within this whole cosmic drama that's unfolding here and, you know, repudiate this idea that we're just a cancer on the earth. And, you know, there's an extreme environmental movement now that basically says we need to get rid of all capitalism. And in fact, we need to get rid of humans so that, well, you know, you could get rid of humans, right? Well, it's, you know, another millennium or two goes by or another few centuries and the next bolide comes in and does more damage to the environment than we've been able to do in, you know, our whole time that we've been here with recorded history. Anyways.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, get rid of humans, but you certainly aren't going to get back to some pristine steady state. That's a total fantasy.
Yeah, it's ideas of, you know, utopia again, or that it's, again, the system is somehow protected like in a bubble, as you say, and that's just not going to be the conditions of it. It wacks, it wanes, things happen to it, it changes. But again, it's like it's those very just as a human being who faces challenges and overcomes those challenges grow. I think the same applies to within the system as well. And again, I'm not advocating and saying that we should now go out and you know cause as much havoc and misery as possible because that ultimately will be good. I mean, that don't take it out of context like that. But the fact is that things in the natural environment they do change. And I think it's those changes and those challenges that has led to the immense diversity that we you know have on the planet, which is beautiful to watch and to witness and to be part of that too. You know.
Yeah. When I moved into where I'm at now, I'm living kind of an old neighborhood, and the house that I live in was the original farmhouse. And then, of course, the land got sold off around it and the, you know, numerous houses. But when I moved in 92, I think it was 91 or 92, near there, they were in the process of putting in a housing development. And they had pretty much bulldozed all but a few trees over a vast tract of acreage. And I remember looking at that and thinking, yeah, I don't like that. You know, just, you know, try to save the trees as much as possible, which of course in my work I always try to do that. But of course then as I learned more about it, I realized that, you know, that economically, you know, to save the trees costs the building process to be much more expensive, hence the houses have to be much more expensive, hence only the upper middle classes can afford them and so on. But what I guess I'm getting at though now is if you drive through that neighborhood now, there's 60-foot trees completely in the whole complex after 20 years.
Right.
You know, you wouldn't even know that 20 years ago it had been just bulldozed barren.
Sure.
Because, yeah. You know, it's a green neighborhood now with trees hanging over the streets in just 20 years of time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's kind of like, you know, if you're 20 years old, you're a young person and your perspective on change is limited. It's much easier, I think, to fall prey to these ideas that, you know, things that there is some steady state. You know, once you've hit half a century or more and you start looking back and you realize, my God, things have changed a lot since I was a kid. You know,
yeah.
Places where I might have played when I was a kid, I wouldn't even recognize now. You know, I've got a hedge in front of my house that we cut every year. 10 years ago, we missed one. It was a small sapling, and it started growing up. So we just left it, and it's a 40-foot tree now. You know, this huge tree casting shadow on my house that 10 years ago was part of a 6-foot-tall hedge, and it just again. You begin, if you start paying attention, you realize, well, you know, changes, even without the intervention of something from outside that, you know, exponentially accelerates the process, things change rapidly. You know, the atmosphere changes, the ocean currents change, lands rise and fall. There are earthquakes that cause, you know, the release of enormous amounts of methane into the atmosphere. I mean, the dynamic processes just are almost too numerous to even to list. And they're all going on, and sometimes they cancel each other out, and other times they amplify each other.
Yeah.
But the point is, take humans out of the equation. No, you're not going to return to some steady state. Things are still going to dynamically change, and things are sometimes going to catastrophically change.
Yep, absolutely. It's it's an argument that, but it's pretty prominent though. It's pretty prevalent. And if you do take some time to watch specifically the new children's movies, the Disney movies, and all these animated movies that comes out, it's amazing to see how many times in those the narrative is that the Earth is the, you know, the death planet or the dark ones or the humans are the evil ones, or, you know, it's like, yeah. Wow, it's like they're really pushing it on these kids these days. You know, it's amazing.
Well, the environmentalist literature, if you look at it now, is filled with stuff like, you know, the planet is in a state of crisis. We're in the midst of the sixth great mass extinction.
Right.
And of course, that's all hypothetical. It's based on computer models that a given number of unknown, unidentified species exists on a given hectare of land or habitat. And if you destroy that habitat, then these unknown species are disappearing. So it's not real species that have been documented to have been gone extinct. And humans are responsible for a number of extinctions, probably about a dozen extinctions. You know, the most famous being the passenger pigeon. But this idea that there are millions of species going extinct, if you ask somebody who's promoting that idea, well, name those species, they won't be able to. You know, I mean, like I said, there's about a dozen documented species for which humans are almost certainly responsible for. Some of those, though, I even question, you know, like the great auk of New Zealand, you know, which is being blamed upon the arrival of the Maori people about 800 years ago. But if you ask the Maori people themselves, they don't concur with that they were responsible for the extinction of the moa bird. And they have their legends about how there was great fire and disruption that burned off the island and caused the extinction. But what the archaeologists have done and the paleontologists is that they looked at this charcoal layer that stretches over New Zealand that seems to occur approximately at the same time as the arrival of the Maori. And they say, well, the Maori came here and they did slash and burn agriculture and essentially burned off all the forests of the island and therefore caused the extinction of the moa.
Hmm.
But when you talk to the Maori themselves, they don't agree with that.
Right.
And so a number of these dozen or so species that I'm talking about fall into that kind of category where it's actually questionable whether humans did in fact trigger the extinction. On the other hand, yes, humans almost caused the extinction of the buffalo. However, that was an intentional effort there, because one of the untold stories about the extinction of the buffalo is that in the post-Civil War era, both Sherman and Sheridan were now, who were part of the Union generals, were shifted from, you know, battling with the Confederates to now battling with the Plains Indians. And they were the ones, and Philip Sheridan was the primary engineer behind this plan to decimate the Plains Indian tribes by undermining the basis of their economy, which right. was the bison.
Yeah.
So they sent the soldiers out deliberately with orders to slaughter the bison. And then because the soldiers by themselves couldn't kill enough of them, they put a bounty on the bison to inspire, you know, bison hunters to go out there and kill as many of them as they can. Sheridan actually said one of his goals was to completely exterminate the buffalo, because by doing that, he would then cause the collapse of the plains tribes in the Great Plains, western, wow. the central.
That's
interesting. And see, that's a story that, you know, it's well verified, but of course nobody's ever taught that in government run schools.
So it was effectively state subsidized, this whole activity, and people got money from it.
It was a state subsidized attempt to exterminate the buffalo, wow. and thereby undermine the Plains Indian tribes to open the doorway for railroads and settlers and so on.
Right, right.
Take the government out of the equation. Yeah, there still would have been decimation of the buffalo, but not to the extent that it was.
Sure. Yeah.
But what's interesting, though, is around the turn of the century, it was private, non-governmental groups that actually began to preserve the buffalo and breed the buffalo and have brought them back to ecological viability.
Yeah, well, I mean, the same thing goes for, as far as I've read, when it comes to land and things like that, that if people actually individually own the land, they have much more, a much bigger stake in actually being responsible for that. They want to make it look nice. They want to take care of it and everything else. But if you actually get the flip side of that, if you have it state-owned or something like that, or no one ends up actually caring about the land, there's no personal incentive there to invest time or effort or anything like that in there. So, I mean, it's all upside down of what we get taught, yeah. and all the propaganda these days about how exactly as you said before, it's all you know, capitalism or free market's fault. You know, there's plenty of free market environmentalism out there as well. You know, so
And it works. You know, the tragedy of the commons is what you're referring to, is the term that's been invoked to describe that, when basically you've got a lot of people competing for resources, but nobody who actually owns anything. And so it's like whoever gets there first.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it's we can see it with, I think it's in Zambia, where they've now started privatizing the elephant herds. And whereas previously elephant herds were becoming a detriment to tribal society, because as tribal society was expanding, the elephant herds were getting in there and disrupting their crops and so forth. And so the tribes were actually poaching the elephants because the elephants were proliferating. Well, once the herds became privatized, the tribes realized that it became a source of income, because now they could, you know, they have a hunting culture themselves, and they know that they can create preserves where tourists can come and pay money to see the elephants. Hunters can come and pay huge sums of money to be able to hunt an elephant. And of course, you know, there might be, again, some people who are aghast at the idea of hunting an elephant, but you know, again, you got to put it in context. What happens to the elephant that's not brought down by a hunter's gun is that elephant essentially slowly, over a long period of many months, starves to death and is eventually oftentimes eaten alive by predators. And, you know, the ultimate fate of that elephant in nature is going to be actually worse than what happens when it's brought down by the hunter's gun. But the tribes that have essentially, in effect, privatized the elephant herds are now seeing, again, a proliferation of elephants. We can see on the western plains and the western prairies of the U.S. the same kind of thing going on, whereas, you know, you had ranchers, for example, that had long-term leases on land for like a century. Mm. So they effectively owned it, and they were able to make improvements, you know, they were able to... you know, if you've got a long-term lease and you realize, okay, if I want to have sustainable cattle grazing, I can't overgraze, because if I overgraze in 3 to 5 years, I've bankrupted myself.
Right.
Exactly. Right. So there's no incentive really to overgraze when you own that property yourself.
Right.
Right. Well, here's what's happened though. It's like the Bureau of Land Management has come in and created all these new rules and regulations that say, okay, if you don't graze X number of cattle on this land each year, we're going to void your lease and turn it over to somebody else. Well, so what happens again is that creates a perverse incentive. And now you have conscientious ranchers that are trying to practice sustainable ranching, and they're finding increasing amounts of bureaucratic interference with that's making it very difficult for them to do that.
Wow.
You know, not being allowed, for example, to develop their water resources is another good example. I mean, there's many examples, and there's been quite a number of books. Carl Hess Jr. has written a really important book documenting the struggle that's gone on in the American West between private ranchers and government bureaucracies, and the perverse incentives that have been imposed upon these private ranchers by these governmental rules and regulations that are now not allowing them literally to practice sustainable ranching.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, it is very much the same, at least, you know, specifically, I should say, within the field of agriculture in the European Union. It has to be among some of the most absurd. And I remember a couple of years ago now, I went through a book called The Great European Ripoff, how the corrupt, wasteful EU is taking control of our lives. We had it linked up many years on the site, but it has some stunning examples of how they, you know, from state level, central government level, you know, basically put pen to paper and decide something, and then they get a reaction to that in the rest of the European, you know, farming agricultural community. And it has been tremendous waste. There's these stories about the lakes of red wine, literally. There was, you know, sheep produced grapes because the state was in there and subsidized this particular crop or that particular plant or something like that. You know, and it's just, it always leads to chaos and mayhem when it's being, when this dumb bigger system is on top of it, instead of people who are locally, and they're right there connected with the people around them. They know what's needed at the time. They're you know, you can't exchange that real life intelligence for some kind of you know, bureaucracy, basically. So
right. Oh yeah, and a perfect example of what you're just talking about is what occurred here in the Midwest during the Depression. You know, the agricultural department came in and encouraged, actually pressured farmers into shifting over into monoculture forms of agriculture. And with that, you know, to buy up a lot of tractors and so forth to, in order to plow the fields on a large scale. And so the government basically came in, brokered the loans that these farmers needed to buy the equipment because the tractor manufacturers wanted to sell it. So the tractor manufacturers are, you know, donating to the politicians, and then the politicians are in turn enacting these programs where they come in and basically teach the farmers into these monocultural methods, then put them into debt to buy the equipment in order to plow up the fields. And what you see is that in the central states like Kansas and Oklahoma, where they did this, you had huge areas of the fields plowed up. Well, this, or huge areas of the prairie plowed up. Well, this was came right at the end of a relatively moist period where a lot of rain for a couple of decades had been falling on the prairie. But, you know, as we now know, there's a natural cycle of drought that occurs, and it lasts for 5 years, 10 years, and then the rains return. Well,
right.
What happened was they plowed up all the prairie grass and the topsoil at the government's instigation. They went into debt to buy this equipment at the government's instigation. And then when the rains didn't come and the drought came, all the topsoil blew away. They didn't have the crops to pay back the debts that they had been encouraged to take on. And therefore, they were dispossessed of their farms and they went out on the road. And this, of course, was the great, you know, migrations that was, you know, documented in stories like The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. But by contrast, in some of the states like the Dakotas, where they didn't implement these programs, the farmers were not in debt. They had diversified agriculture. And like my grandmother on my father's side grew up in a farm in North Dakota, lived through the Depression. My former father-in-law also grew up in North Dakota. They both said the same story. We barely noticed the Depression, you know, that because they weren't in debt. They had diversified crops.
Yeah.
Neighbors came together. There was prolific bartering that was going on.
Yeah.
You know, one farmer was, you know, had cattle and was producing milk and cheese. And, you know, somebody else had chickens with eggs. Somebody else was growing wheat. Somebody else had vegetable gardens. And they got along quite well throughout the Depression.
And see, that's free market right there. There's no crony capitalism there, you know. That works. That works just
exactly.
Fine, you know.
No crony capitalism there. That's the free market. And so many people on the left, when they start criticizing markets and capitalism, they're failing to distinguish between capitalism of the free market variety and capitalism of the crony variety.
Yep, indeed. Well, it's all very, very good points, very, very sobering and great stuff. You know, I think there's a lot to ponder there, Randall, and tie that into all the things that we've been discussing, from, of course, the cosmic origins to, you know, to the Holy Grail, and then all the way around to how we're dealing and basically surviving on this planet. But is there anything you'd like to leave us with? I mean, there's a couple of things I want to give out here before we do so. Obviously, the website again, sacredgeometryinternational.com. That's where all of you guys out there can find more information. Check out the courses there as well. The how to learn sacred geometry. The DVD is there. Cosmic Patterns and Cycles of Catastrophe, and all the articles and everything else. But Randall, yeah, if there's anything else you want to plug or mention, please go ahead.
Well, let's see. I'll mention. You know, I've gotten to know Graham Hancock quite well here recently, and his work is, I find, very complimentary to what I've been doing, because what he's been doing is focusing on, you know, the evidence for former levels of civilization beyond, you know, what is currently recognized by Orthodox history. And then he touches upon the idea of what forces of nature, or what were events were responsible for essentially, you know, destroying those civilizations or erasing the evidence. On the other hand, I've been working on focusing primarily on understanding the nature of these catastrophes, and most particularly the catastrophe at the Pleistocene-Holocene boundary around 12,000 to 13,000 years ago, which seems to have been, in my perspective on it, probably the most significant event that has happened since we humans have been on this planet, at least in terms, if we look at the severity of event being measured by the number of species lost, we have to go back 5 million years to find an equivalent event. And so the events that transpired 11 or 12,000 years ago, I essentially interpret as being like the great curtain coming down on the stage of human history and obscuring everything that's on the backside of the stage. And this early spring or next summer, we're planning to go, assist Graham with some of his research into showing him some of these sites that I've been studying firsthand in the field, that are clearly evidence, just dramatic evidence of these extreme global events, you know, gigantic flooding events and erosional events and sedimentation events. And so we're planning to do that. And I think that's going to be a pretty significant adventure that we hopefully will embark on next May or June.
Yeah, wow, that sounds really interesting and fascinating, as well as really cool to see when people, you know, get together and the research kind of dovetails in that way and expand on each other. So yeah, that's good stuff. Looking forward to that. And I guess, of course, you guys will have more info about that on the website when that occurs as well, right? So.
Oh, yes. And, you know, this is all for his research for the sequel to Fingerprints of the Gods.
That's right.
He will be writing. So all of this stuff that we're doing in these field trips and so forth is going to be included within that, within a sequel, which is going to be called Magicians of the Gods. So hopefully I will be able to contribute something to that and may even be included within the book.
Well, excellent. Well, looking forward to that, Randall. That's going to be great. Please, you know, keep up the good work, and we'll have to do this again at some point and touch base again in the future. So thanks again for coming on.
Oh, you're welcome, Henrik. Enjoyed it very much.
Well, there you go. That's our program for today. A big thanks to all our members. Either if you're a new member or a dedicated listener who have been with us for a while, we do appreciate all of you. And our hat goes off to you for making this program possible and for helping us expand and grow in our productions. Some of our upcoming guests include Sterling Allen, James Hall, David Talbot, Walter Block, and Richard Dewhurst. For Frederick, Lana, Elizabeth, John, and myself, we say thank you for listening, and please take good care of yourself. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.